Numbers chapter 14, Numbers chapter 14 this evening. Numbers chapter 14, and we're going to jump to verse number 22. Numbers 14 and verse 22. Are you there? Numbers 14, verse 22 says, "Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoked me see it." They've tempted me now these 10 times. I want to look at this word tempted and consider these 10 times this evening as we look through a brief history of the children of Israel in the wilderness. Now, when we consider the word tempted, what does it mean to tempt? Well, that idea of to test, the word's even used to prove. The Hebrew word under consideration this evening means to prove, as David uses the word in the account of David when he tried on the armor of Saul. Remember that? And he had not proved it. It's to test something or to tempt, but not in the typical American way of thinking of tempting. It's not talking about a seduction, but it's more talking about a test and a proving of something to see what it really is, if you will. We use it in our English terminology. Maybe somebody's really irritating and you say, "You're testing my patience." you're applying a test to my patience to see just how strong it is. Or we might come say to somebody, a close friend, "I'm really going through a trial." A trial. James 1:2 says, "Brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations," or trials, idea there, "knowing that the trying of your faith worketh patience." So some sort of a pressure is applied to your faith, and in the process, you're made stronger, and that's the kind of temptation. There's something that tries you, that tests you, that in essence proves you. The trying of your strength, the reality of your faith. When David proved or hadn't proved Saul's armor, it's that he hadn't tried it out. He hadn't tested how well it would work. When Israel tempted the Lord, they were putting God on trial. It's as if they were making him the defendant. He had to prove his case. They were, as it were, if I could put it this way, administering a test. They were making God the student and themselves the administrators, giving him the test, seeing if he would pass their examination. It was an irreverent, humanistic approach that attempted to make God meet their qualifications instead of trusting him, resting on him, or as we say, taking him at his word. So he says in this verse, "These that have tempted me now these 10 times. I was curious when I read that one time and thought, 10 times. I wonder if those 10 times are mentioned in Scripture. I'm going to go through some, and I submit that possibly these are the 10 times, and indeed they are recorded for us in the Scripture. We go back to the book of Exodus in chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14. And they have no sooner left the land of Egypt. God has broken their bondage. He's delivered them with a mighty arm. They strike out and they're in progress. They haven't even reached the Red Sea. And Pharaoh in anger begins to approach. He wants them back. He's angry now. And Exodus chapter 14, verse 10 says, "And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord, and they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Immediately there's a doubt and an accusation. And you'll see time after time, I really, from our vantage point, you know, hindsight and being so far removed, it's kind of funny, their response. Now, we might not have thought it was so funny if we were found in that same situation. But they say, oh, there weren't enough graves, so you had to bring us out here to die. And they feared. Yet in verse 13, God in his mercy says, well, Moses says, fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show you today. For the Egyptians whom ye have seen today, ye shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and ye shall hold your peace. But temptation number one, it says, he says in verse number 12 there, they not only feared and said there were no graves, but notice this, is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Omniscient God. Okay. Now, they're talking to Moses, but who is Moses the representative of? God, the God-appointed leader, the deliverer of the children of Israel. And they say, isn't this what we told you? It would be better for us to serve in Egypt. That's an interesting take on liberty, isn't it? They certainly weren't for give me liberty or give me death. It'd be better to serve in bondage than to be out here. Temptation number one. We go to the next chapter, not very long after. And now they've passed through the Red Sea. They've seen the destruction of Pharaoh's army. They've rejoiced and sang together. And now in chapter 15 and verse 23, they went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water, in verse 23. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the water of Marah, for they were bitter. That is, the waters were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah. And the people, noted the word, murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them, and said, if thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, and wilt do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that healeth thee. Now, it'd be one thing if they said, Lord, there's no water, and we can't just produce water. Please provide water. But no, it was a temptation. It was a trial. It was a test because they murmured, what are we going to drink? What plans have you made? And yet the Lord provided a way to make the water sweet so they could drink. Well, again, it's not very long after, and in chapter 16, we begin right there in verse number 1. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came unto the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The children of Israel said unto them, would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt. And we preached on this here a few weeks back. When we sat by the flesh pots, when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Not just a murmuring, not just a complaint. It has to end up in an accusation, doesn't it? A bitter accusation, impugning God's integrity. The despising, you know, doubting his plan and his power and his nature. You've brought us forth to kill this whole assembly with hunger. And verse 4, Then said the Lord unto Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. Now God's allowed to be the test giver. But when the creation turns on the Creator, puts him on trial, gives him the test, and says, You pass my test. You show yourself strong in the way that I want you to. You prove yourself to me. Why, that is arrogant. And that is testing the Lord. And that was the third time right there. Just in that same chapter then, we move on, and they give instructions about this manna. Now, this manna is a new thing. It comes down, and appears in the morning, and they can go out, and they can gather so much, and there actually was a portion control. If you look in verse number 16, this is the thing which the Lord hath commanded, gather of it every man according to his eating, an omer for every man according to the number of your persons, take ye every man for them which are in his tents. So, supposed to take a certain amount and go out and gather it. And so the children of Israel did so and gathered some more, some less, okay, according to their eating. And when they did mete it out with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating. And Moses said, Let no man leave of it till the morning. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses. But some of them left of it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was wroth with them. Even in a little instruction, you got this brand new food. God's providing you bread out of heaven. Now get this much and don't leave it until the morning. I mean, the instructions are pretty simple, but some of it left it until the morning. They forgot, it was so busy after doing the chores, I forgot to dump it out, whatever. Or was it a doubting of God's plan and someone, if I dump it out, what if we don't see it again? Well, what if I want some extras? He's given us this much, but what if I want a little more? And so they kept it. They disobeyed his voice, and Moses rightly was wroth with them. He was angry. And then in verse number 26 of the same chapter, he says, 6 days shall ye gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. Okay, so you're going to gather 6 days, but you're not going to gather on the seventh because there won't be any. But, verse 27, it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather. And they found none, just like God had said. Don't go out and gather. There won't be any. But maybe God doesn't know. Maybe Moses does. What did they really think? Well, I don't know if Moses really knows all that. Or, well, maybe if I go out, God will see that I want a little bit more, and he'll give me some. Whatever their thought process was, in that simple instruction, what is it doing? I'm going to push the limit. I'm going to push the line. I'm going to question your plan. I'm going to tempt or test you, as it were, and test your patience. So they went some out on people on the seventh day. And notice what he says in verse 28. And the Lord said unto Moses, How long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for that the Lord hath given you the Sabbath, therefore he giveth you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide ye every man in his place, let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. I've given you what you need. I've given you instructions on how to do it. But I want to try it my own way. Well, we go to chapter 17. Chapter 17, verse 1. And all the congregation of the children of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys according to the commandment of the Lord and pitched in Rephidim. There was no water for the people to drink. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses. Chide. Again, that idea of to argue with, and according to one source, it can even be, now it's probably more of a derived sense, but literally to have a lawsuit. And that's in essence what they're doing, isn't it? When we chide with you, we're saying, this isn't right. This isn't just. What does it mean to be just? It means to adhere to the law, to right, to the nature of God, if you understand what right is. And they're chiding with Moses. They're arguing with him. In essence, this isn't right. But in the process, what are they doing? What are they saying? God isn't righteous? Or do you start to see the gravity of what they're saying? Oh, they're just complaining. They're just a little upset. They're impugning the very character of God. And they chide with Moses. And they say, verse 2, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said unto them, notice the two statements. Notice the parallel here. Why chide ye with me? Wherefore do ye tempt the Lord? To argue with me is to test God. To put me on trial, to take me to court with your opinion, as it were, is to try the Lord himself, to question his ways. He said, wherefore do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses, and they said, wherefore is this that thou hast brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? And Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, what shall I do unto this people? They be almost ready to stone me. They're violently responding to this. Now, to step back for a minute, only days before, they had been under bondage to this world power. And they had seen through event after event, in a period of days, God accomplish these amazing miracles, these plagues on this world power that brought them to their knees, that economically devastated them, that showed himself powerful against the gods of Egypt. They marched out victoriously and gladly, until finally at the Red Sea, they saw the army of that world power demolished. What a God they serve. If he could do that, couldn't he do anything? Give us water. Why are you bringing us out here to kill us and our children? Really? What a question. What an accusation against the Lord. And he said, they'd be ready almost to stone me. Now look at verse 5. The Lord said unto Moses, go on before the people, and take with thee the elders of Israel, and thy rod wherewith thou smotest the river. Take in thine hand and go. Behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb. Thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the chiding of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Do you see the test? Are you going to show, are you with us or not? You prove to us that you're here. Our way. And I want you to notice two things about this. Number one, now you might think that after striking the rock and millions of water, gallons of water gushing out of this rock and feeding this nation of an estimated 2 million people and their livestock, that'd kind of cure you, wouldn't it? Oh, my bad, my goodness, who was I to doubt? God can obviously provide. Never will question that again, will we? And Moses actually names the place. There's a spot on the map that commemorates their temptation, their trial. It's interesting. To be able to travel and remember a spot for the sin you committed there. I'm going to call this place Massa and Meribah because of your attitude, because of your ungodliness in tempting the Lord and saying, is he among us or not? Wow. Now we skip over to Exodus chapter 32. Exodus 32, now in their journeys, they've come all the way to Mount Sinai. And Moses has ascended the mount, there receiving the law of the Lord, engraved in stone. And as we preached just recently, while he's up there 40 days, the people say in chapter 32, in verse number 1, and when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron, Moses' assistant, if you will, his mouthpiece. And he said unto him, and they said unto him, up, make us gods, or make us Elohim, which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we what not, we don't know what has become of him. And so Aaron says, okay, break off the golden earrings and give me your gold. And they give him the gold, and it's so much gold that he can melt it down and craft out of that gold a calf, a golden calf. Up, make us Elohim, which shall go before us. Of course, we noticed in that text here, I believe it was just here Wednesday or the Wednesday before, that in some ways it's represented as the true God. That's as the worship of the true God. And yet it's this creature, a four-footed beast. It's a tremendous perversion of the perspective of God and of their religion. And Aaron facilitates it. God notifies Moses. People are sinning. Moses descends. They think there's the sound of, Joshua thinks there's the sound of war. Moses says, no, it's not the sound of war. It's the sound of them singing, do I hear? So certainly they come down to find a raucous, chaotic music. It says there's dancing. It says there's uncovering or even nakedness there. Obviously, this calf and the attendant music and the activities and the style of apparel, if you will, all were consistent with each other. The way they were worshiping was in a degenerate way. Moses grinds the calf into dust, throws it in the water, makes the people drink. Says, who is on the Lord's side? The Levites come over to him. He tells them to go and to slay the unrepentant. And then the Lord plagues the people. Are there individual consequences to sin? Yes. Yes, there are. And yet there's a greater consequence coming. In Numbers chapter 11, now we skip to the book of Numbers. And chapter number 11, Numbers 11, Numbers 11, verse number 1, it says, and when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, and the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burnt among them and consumed in the uttermost parts of the camp. Now, what exactly that was, we don't know. What that looked like, I'm not for sure. Was it in some way, I don't know how to describe it exactly, what this fire was that went throughout the camp, but it was a literal fire, and in some way it was something literal that was consuming people. It was a burning. It's a judgment from the Lord. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto the Lord, the fire was quenched. And again, he called the name of the place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burnt among them. It's significant. In this place, a different name, similar sin. There was a burning, there was a judgment in this place. You can imagine 100 years later, why do they call this place Taberah? There was a judgment here. The fire of the Lord went throughout the camp, consumed people. Why? Because they complained again. They complained. That was the eighth time, the eighth temptation, as I record in this list. And then we come to the next verse. And the mixed multitude apparently a group of, I'd say, Egyptians who have mixed with them, who probably liked the power, if you will, of their God and kind of escorted them as they left victoriously out of Egypt and said, yeah, we could be a part of this. And yet they're a mixed multitude. The mixed multitude that was among them fell a-lusting. And the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic, but now our soul is dried away. There's nothing at all beside this manna before our eyes. Oh, we remember how good we had it in slavery. We remember all the good food we could eat when we weren't slaving away. And we ate it freely, and now all we have is this bread from heaven. And we're dried up. Oh, again, they're lusting. They're complaining. Compare, you know, what are they saying? God, what you provide now isn't nearly as good as what we had in bondage. You don't provide enough. What you provide is inadequate. It's not superior, not enough to suffice our lusts. And so, he says here, let me find my verse again. Verse 10, Moses heard the people weep throughout their families, every man in the door of his tent. Almost sounds like a baby fest, does it? I mean, doesn't it sound kind of whiny? They're weeping in the door of their tent. And the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly. Moses also was displeased. And then Moses gets frustrated. He communicates with the Lord, I can't handle this. Why? How can I bear these people? I'm not able to bear it, he says. I'm not able to bear it alone because it's too heavy for me, verse 14. And any of you deal thus with me, kill me, I pray thee, out of hand. And the Lord actually answers Moses' own expression of frustration by putting his spirit on other men to help at the same time. And yet, we see in verse number 20, God says, oh, I'll give them flesh to eat. And they're not just going to eat it one day or two or five or 10 or even 20, but even verse 20, a whole month until it come out at your nostrils and it be loathsome unto you because ye have despised, rejected the Lord which is among you. You've rejected the Lord which is among you because you're lusting for stuff. And ye have wept before him, saying, why came we forth out of Egypt? Amazing. Especially when you recognize that Egypt is very clearly a picture of bondage, more than a picture. That's actually what it was to them, bondage. And when we as believers, in the abundance of the Lord and in his daily provision, we look back at an old life of bondage and go, oh, we had it better then. God, what you're giving me now, I'm drying away. It doesn't match. Oh, to be what I used to be, to be where I used to be. What a slap in the face of God. And so, he says, I'll provide enough meat for him to eat for a whole month. Come out at their nostrils. Of course, Moses is incredulous. How could we find meat like that? Of course, the Lord's entirely able to do that. And then verse number 31. There went forth a wind from the Lord and brought quails from the sea and let them fall by the camp as it were a day's journey on this side and as it were a day's journey on the other side round about the camp and as it were 2 cubits high upon the face of the earth. And the people stood up all that day and all that night and all the next day and they gathered the quails. He that gathered least gathered 10 omers. And they spread them all abroad for themselves round about the camp. Boy, they're just having a time with their quail fry here or their quail cooking. And boy, they got them on the spits and maybe they're putting some spices on them. Oh, they just look so good. And they begin to dig in and their lustful selves just starting to, I want to say gorge, maybe. And while the flesh was yet between their teeth, before it was even chewed, the wrath of the Lord was kindled against the people, and the Lord smote the people with a very great plague. And he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people that lusted. Kibroth Hattaavah, what does it mean? Graves of lust. There are the graves of lust. Why, Dad? Because they wanted something from God. They wanted more. What they said what God had given them wasn't enough. They lusted against the Lord, impugned his very character, until he finally gave them what they wanted. And now they're in the grave of lust. And I thought of this passage in Psalm 106 and verse 15. And as I read it again, in studying for this, I used to kind of narrow that verse to this specific incident. And yet, listen to it. Psalm 106 and verse 15. And he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. Now, is that true of this occasion? I believe so, but I think it applies to more. Let me back up a few verses. It says, he rebuked the Red Sea, and it was dried up. So he led them through the depths as through the wilderness. And he saved them from the hand of him that hated them and redeemed them from the hand of the enemy. The waters covered their enemies. This is the Egyptians. There was not one of them left. Then believed they his words. They sang his praise. They soon forgot his works. They waited not for his counsel, but lusted exceedingly in the wilderness and tempted God in the desert. And he gave them their request, but sent leanness into their soul. Could it be that with every temptation, every time they said, God, give us, and he did provide, he mercifully provided their water and manna and you know, different things. But in each time, the way they had approached it and the way they had put God to the test, while they got what they wanted, yet they lost a wholeness about them. They weren't at peace with God. There was a leanness to them soul, to their soul. You couldn't describe them with the Hebrew term shalom. They weren't at peace. And then, number 10, we go to Numbers chapter 13. Numbers 13. And now they've arrived at the border of the promised land. They send in 12 spies to scope out the land, to come back and to give a report. Now, you know that the point of the spies wasn't to come back and say, thumbs up or thumbs down, because this was the promised land. God had already promised this generations before. He had delivered them now from Egypt to bring them to the promised land. It wasn't theirs to decide whether they could take it or not. But the 12 spies, they go throughout the land and they bring back even of the fruit of the land. Look at chapter 13 and verse 26. And they went and came to Moses and to Aaron and to all the congregation of the children of Israel unto the wilderness of Paran to Kadesh and brought back word unto them and unto all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. You remember the grapes that were hanging from a pole between two guys? They showed them the fruit of the land. And they told him and said, we came into the land whither thou sentest us, and surely it floweth with milk and honey, and this is the fruit of it. Woo! If we stop the video right there, it's a great ending. But it doesn't stop. Nevertheless, verse 28, the people be strong that dwell in the land, and the cities are walled and very great. And moreover, we saw the children of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and he talks about different people. But Caleb, notice, now the people are starting to get anxious. They're starting to murmur. And Caleb stilled the people before Moses, and he said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we are well able to overcome it." But the men that went up with him, now the other 10 spies, they say, "We be not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we." And they brought up an evil report of the land which they had searched unto the children of Israel, saying, "The land through which we have gone to search it is a land that eateth up the inhabitants thereof, and all the people that we saw of it are men of great stature." Well, I have the feeling that's an exaggeration. "And there we saw the giants, the sons of Anak, which come of the giants, and we were to in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. We know because we asked them." No, that's an assumption. "But we're going to cast doubt and sow fear and tell you, this can't be done. Now, I know God promised it to us, and this is the direction that we've been headed. And for generations past now, we've known. But this cannot be done by what we can see." And Caleb, the man of faith, of course, is saying, "We are well able to do this." But they brought up, the Bible says, an evil report of the land. And chapter 14, verse 1 says, "And all the congregation lifted up their voice and cried. And the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses." Now watch the progression here. "And against Aaron. And the whole congregation said unto them, Would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in this wilderness? And wherefore hath the Lord brought us unto this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt?" And they said one to another, "Let us make a captain and let us return into Egypt." Wow. And we'd have thought passing through the Red Sea that have solved that. We'd have thought maybe seeing the 10 plagues would have helped cure that. We'd have thought that the gallons of water gushing out of a rock might have helped that. And now, on the brink of victory, they say, "Let's make us a captain and go back." Wow. On the brink of victory. And then we come to verse number 5, you can imagine that response, that visceral response. "Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel." What are you saying? Joshua and Caleb rent their clothes, encouraged them, said in verse 8, "If the Lord delight in us, he will bring us into this land and give it us, a land which floweth with milk and honey. Only rebel not ye against the Lord, neither fear ye the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their defense is departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Fear them not." Now, do you remember some 40 years later, we preached on it just this morning, two spies went into the land. And they lodged they found a house of a lady named Rahab. And what did she say? "People are terrified because of you. They know what your God did to divide the Red Sea and how you defeated the kings of the Amorites," right? Now that happened a little later, but we know your God. We've heard what he's done. And we're scared. They didn't act like it. Not the 10 spies, but the two said, "Their defense is departed from them." And they were exactly right. They had faith in the Lord. In verse 11, "The Lord said unto Moses, How long will this people provoke me? And how long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I have showed? I will smite them with the pestilence and disinherit them and will make thee a greater nation than Moses prays there." But our text again, Numbers 14, verse 22. "Because all those men which have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, and have tempted me now these 10 times." and have not hearkened to my voice, surely they shall not see the land which I swear unto their fathers. Neither shall any of them that provoked me see it, but my servant Caleb. Now he'll make it. Joshua will make it. Now we may blame Israel, but if our temptations of God were recorded for humanity, would we fare any better? The question is not, have you tempted God? The question is now, am I tempting God? Are you trying his patience? Are you putting him to a test? I wonder at what point, if in your life you continue to put him to the test and doubt him and impugn his character and question his design and refuse him and want more and lust after other things and you question him and you provoke him, at what point and to what degree are you forfeiting victory? It has to be a point, it has to be a degree, where long enough we've questioned God and we've put him off and we've refused to walk by faith. We haven't believed God. We haven't said he is firm in what he says, I'll believe and I'll move forward despite what I may see. We've backed away and we've allowed ourselves to lust and to question and to weep and to murmur and to fight and to chide. At some point we stand on the edge of victory, and in some way, like he says to them, all right, enough. None of you are going to enter into the promised land. You're all going to die in the wilderness. And that victory, that blessing, which I planned for you, and by faith you could have had, is now reserved for the next generation. I don't want me to make it sound like you're one heartbeat away. But I do want to question, how much are you pushing against God? How much are you questioning him? Because you are going to sacrifice victory. You're going to affect your children. You're giving an example. So are you submitting to God's design, or are you making him pass your test? God, I'll make the rules. You show yourself strong in the way that I want you to show. If you do this, then you're God. Okay, I believe in you now. Oh, now I want this. If you do this, then you're God. Now, how about we submit to the Lord, we follow him, and as servants, we be thankful for how he blesses us in his design. Are you wanting God to measure up to your plan, or are you submitting to his plan? Let's train our thinking right now by reminding ourselves of who he is. He's the all-wise God. He is love. He's the Almighty. He's the sovereign creator, designer, definer, and sustainer of the world. He is the God who determines, who is what is right. He's the definer of good, and he's the giver of peace. We'll find the peace that we need, not when God meets our conditions, but when we conform to his design. Then we can experience that wholeness, that fullness, the victory of walking by faith.